What stimulated you to get involved in researching this? How did it come about? What are some other projects perhaps that you're working on now that are sort of related to it?
Okay, well, I can begin by telling you how I got into this. As you may know, to become a member of MoveOn, oftentimes you're recommended by or referred to by friends. And so I got an email forwarded to me from MoveOn, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. So I became a member, and I kept getting all these emails. And finally, I thought, you know, I should do something with this. And I first wrote an article about how they created collective identity through their emails. And then I was talking to a colleague, Floyd Anderson, who was one of the co-authors of the Anderson and King piece, and he wanted me to be on a panel where they talked about the rhetoric of polarization. And once I read his piece, I realized that what MoveOn was doing in their emails was actually using this rhetoric of polarization. And I decided I wanted to explore it a little bit more and pull in the work of Rahm and Meisel, and then it was suggested I pull in the work of Cheney on identification. And so doing that, I created this model of polarization rhetoric that is referenced in my article, which is used to look at the MoveOn emails. And so if you want, I'll give you a little overview of the article if you want, or what would you
Please,
like?
that'd be great.
Okay. Well, you know from Anderson and or King and Anderson that polarization is a rhetorical phenomenon that may be defined as a process by which an extremely diversified public is coalesced into two or more highly contrasting, mutually exclusive groups, sharing a high degree of internal solidarity in those beliefs which a persuader considers salient. And so what I did was I took the work of King and Anderson, and they had talked about polarization involving a strategy of affirmation and a strategy of subversion. And so within my model, I acknowledged the importance of creating feelings of solidarity in your rhetoric of polarization, but also creating a perception of a common foe. And so within the MoveOn emails, what the article points out is that they use the self-justification image strategy, so they made people have this common identity as progressives. They also use the common ground tactics in which they express the concern for the individual, you know, the individual members. Nobody pays a membership due to be part of MoveOn, but this is what they call their group members. And then they also emphasize shared values, and so they talk about the values of the progressives, these shared beliefs. And in terms of the time period of the study that I looked at, you know, they were looking at anti-war values and pro-healthcare values and things like that. They also use a strategy of emphasizing benefits of membership. And so they really stress that as a collective, as a group of members, they could achieve so much. And so being a member of this organization was what was key. It wasn't just one individual. Another strategy they used to create this identity was the assumed we that Cheney talks about. So a lot of their emails talk about, you know, that we can find a way, or together we'll do this. And so they set up that dichotomy of the we versus they, identifying who's in the group and who's out of the group. And so this creation of identification, a feeling of solidarity, is key. Coupled with that, they have that strategy of subversion where they're creating the perception of a common foe. So now we're a group, and who are we against? And so they were against, or are against, non-progressives. And so even, you know, some people might think, well, the Democrats are on their side, aren't they? Well, no, not necessarily. They were against Democrats who might not be voting the way that they thought that they should be. So anyone who didn't share their progressive values was somebody that was perceived as an enemy. During the time period of the study, the big enemy was President Bush and his administration. And so they really sought to weaken and destroy his credibility. So many of the emails referred to him as a scrub. They said he was a liar. They talked about his illegal activity, said he was misguided, he was misleading the public. They also sought to exploit fears as a strategy for, you know, creating this common foe. And so in terms of President Bush and the time period of study, one of the big fears was war. And so we were at war with Iraq. It was an ongoing, unpopular war. And there was a threat of the war with Iran. And so they really played up that that fear that people had that we'd be getting into another unwinnable long war. The emails also touched on issues like illegal wiretapping and the fears associated with that would be, you know, that the government could get away with something like this, infringing on our personal freedoms and, you know, undermining our justice system. And the emails also touched on topics like children's health care. And so President Bush had vetoed support for children's health care. And so this taps into the fear that, you know, we're willing to let children suffer and to die. And so, you know, we'll... is a horrible enemy to have, someone who doesn't even care about children. And so they created Bush and his administration as a common enemy. And so these were key elements of the rhetoric polarization, creating identity, but also creating the perception of a common foe. But to be effective, polarization rhetoric also has to be operating within the proper environment. And so the model recognizes the importance of existence of polarization prior to, you know, an environment that already has some pre-existing polarization, because the rhetoric itself is not going to create it. So we already know that, you know, people were upset with the war, they were anti-war, they were anti-Bush, anti-Republican. So there were groups that already had these feelings of polarization, and Move On through its rhetoric sought to unite the citizens who had a dissatisfaction with the government. Another environmental issue is that you have to it's usually emotionally charged already. So we're talking about issues that, you know, people get very passionate about. So things like the war, the threat of war with Iran, you know, children's health care, the threats to our liberties through illegal wiretapping. So emotional charged issues. And then the final element that's important in terms of this model of rhetoric polarization is that the agents see the world as a battle of opposites, and they present themselves as the only redeemer. So, you know, they really see setting up this battle. And so it goes back to this dichotomy that they create of the, you know, progressives versus non-progressives, or it was Move On versus Bush. The unique thing, though, about Move On is that it didn't present one individual as the redeemer. It was the organization itself that was seen as the redeemer, that they, this collection of individuals or members that shared values could work together, and together they could achieve their goals. And so the success of the emails in terms of using this rhetoric polarization can be seen in the increased membership that Move On has seen, as well as the activism of those members. And the activism is made pretty easy to do because of the internet. All that people had to do if they want to donate money was press on a button, or if you want to sign a petition, you know, click on the link. And so it helped to get people more involved. So it's one of the benefits, too, of using this email, is that you can reach out to a lot more people and you can get them involved in participating. So this is kind of general overview of the model and how it applies to Move On at that time. The ease in which people can become involved is definitely important. This idea that you can reach out to others, and with it, Move On uses the email in terms of distribution, where you do friends refer friends, you know, kind of passing it along. It's almost like word of mouth passing that along this information versus, you know, if you were to go up and try to hand somebody a pamphlet and, you know, try to share political views with them. So I think that helps too, is that you can reach out to many different people who maybe didn't realize that they had similar points of view, and then you can provide them with a way to become involved. You know, people don't come to this without any pre-existing beliefs or attitudes about things. So whatever their beliefs are might drive them to Christian Monitor, or, you know, I find it hard. I don't think you could just create polarization. There's got to be something underlying within people. I don't think they're that persuaded by just a medium. You're asking about desensitization, how people are so exposed to political advertisements and things like that, that they might become desensitized to the rhetorical tools of polarization and just kind of not be persuaded by it? Okay. I think you run that risk of people becoming desensitized, especially nowadays, right? We're inundated with all these political ads and information about things that are happening, and people kind of tune out to it and doesn't have an effect on them. But might go back to, it might have an impact, because the thing is that we want, if we can tap into somebody's beliefs, so they may be desensitized to all this, but if you're putting a message out there that has relevance to the audience member, then they might pay more attention to it, and it might have an impact on them. So it depends on their belief system and if they find the information to be relevant. So if somebody's firmly anti-war, they're not going to become desensitized to the medium or the messages that say, you know, let's continue to have anti-war demonstrations and be against this. They're going to believe that, right? And so the other thing is the idea of selective perception might come into play, that we may be desensitized, but we also may be exposed to these messages and take from them a different meaning than is intended. So they might still have an influence on us. But it's awful hard. There's so much clutter out there, too. So it's not just desensitization that's occurring. It's all the information, the clutter. So these ads have to stand out. The rhetoric has to stand out to get people to pay attention and to even have an influence. I think the advantage of MoveOn is that they have a targeted audience, right? So they have people that they know already have some leanings toward their beliefs, and they can influence that way. If you're sending out emails randomly to general population, they're going to just trash them, right? So they're not going to pay any attention and be influenced. So the main goal of the rhetoric of polarization is to find people and get them to respond the way that you want them to. So tap into this belief system that you think is important, have them take sides, right? Make them agree to the fact that they're one side or another, and they have to just decide which side they want to be on. So
it's a pretty interesting hypothesis to suggest that the increase in the sophistication of the tailoring of the message actually counters the desensitization from just, you know, the rabid political advertisements that occur. And with email or with MoveOn's, you know, databases as large as they are, we could imagine that they, in fact, can know exactly who you are. They know what your political affiliations are. They may even know some of your consumer habits.
When did MoveOn shift from opposition to the war to more of a attack on Bush? Is that what you said?
Because I agree with MoveOn's stance on the war, and I think most people would. But I think some, and I would agree with them, that they went from a rational opposition to the war to personally attacking the president, who felt that was responsible.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they
crossed over. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure when that happened. I'd have to look at the data a little bit more in a longer period than just a few months that I looked at more closely here for this paper. But I think what was important to MoveOn in terms of the rhetoric polarization was that they wanted to have that foe, and Bush made an easy foe, an individual that they could point out to as the one that was the problem. And so that's why I kind of crossed over. He was an easy target, I guess, unfortunately. But and then your second question was about?
It was about, is it possible for an opponent to define their own character without presenting the opponent's ethos for contrast?
So present yourself without
without disparaging your opponent.
I mean, one of the key elements is presenting this common foe. So I guess the way that you go about it is determined by you as the writer. The most common way is to point out the key differences between you and your opponent, and pointing to the negatives. You know, you want to create them as being perceived as a threat and playing into fears of people. So I think it'd be a little tricky to try to express your positives without pointing to the other side in terms of this polarization, because the key is to contrast the two sides and make people see that your side is the clear side that they should be on versus the other one, which is not as good.
So what I'm asking is, does it grow with the amount of followers, the issues, or the nation's focus on politics?
It's a good question. I think it's got to be related to the issues, because once you can tap into issues that are important to people, then you're going to increase your following even more. So if you can tap into things that are important to people, and it's not just the political that would drive it, because what the people are doing in Washington aren't necessarily what the people in the general population are focusing on. So I think the members do have a say, though, particularly in MoveOn. They are very conscious of asking members, what are the issues we should be addressing? What kind of job have we done? Most recently, well, a few months ago, they sent out an email to all the members asking if they should, if the organization should endorse President Obama or not. So the members play a role, but it's, I think it's the issues and making sure that people understand that this should be important and you need to be a part of this group because of these important issues that, that help to raise the membership. So it's kind of a combination, right? Members help to drive the issues, but the more issues tap into that are important to people and salient with them, you can draw in more members.
So as we're talking about how right now we're inundated with politics and election opinion, do you believe that one or more of these techniques are especially prevalent in this campaign, or does one side tend to favor certain strategies?
I think they're both important. I think that the identification through antithesis seems to be a strong theme, you know, the Romney's the enemy of the Democrats, and Obama is, of course, the enemy of the Republicans. And, you know, and within that, we see them going back and forth and really trying to talk about the threat that each one poses for our country in terms of their political ads and things like that. So if you believe what they say, we're in trouble either way, it seems, right? That they're both evil, terrible people, but that's not true. So I think that identification through antithesis, you know, really, you know, coming together against this this common enemy has been prevalent. The assumed we, well, you know, that comes into play a little bit when we're talking about the 99% versus the 1%. So, you know, 99%, that's a lot of us, right? So we can all say, we are part of this movement to make things better for 99% of the country. Now we also have, thanks to Romney, the 47% that are coming together. So you get people from all different backgrounds who maybe didn't have as much in common that it can coalesce together and kind of move forward in the political scene. So I think that's important. Common ground. Yeah, it's probably in there too, but I think that the identification through antithesis is really a driving force in the political scene right now. But it seems as though today things have gotten a little out of hand in terms of polarization, and people are lacking trying to find any kind of common ground on things. So we can't have things so totally different that, you know, it's either one side or the other. There's got to be some common ground that we can agree on. And so if we could see a little bit more of that, that'd be a nicer place to live, right?
Indeed. You don't have any solutions there to get us there, do you?
No, or else I'd run for office.
Right.
No, I'd never do that.
In what ways have affirmation and subversion become tactics to the same end, or perhaps even become indistinguishable from one another?
Oh, okay. That's a good question. Indistinguishable. Well, I think they actually go hand in hand. You can't have one without the other. And so you're always going to have these two, and they're going to vary to degrees which one is going to be dominating the conversation, but you have to have both. Because if you don't have that commonality, that identification together, then you together can't stand against the common foe. But you've got to have somebody that you're standing against. And so I don't think they become indistinguishable, but I think they're both there, and it's just, you know, which one's dominating at the time. But you can't have one without the other, really. I mean, it's no sense having a common foe if nobody's coming together against them.